Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. I'm going to finish the story that I started last time. It was entitled, Doctors Gave Her Antipsychotics. She decided to live with her voices. A new movement wants to shift mainstream thinking away from medication and toward greater acceptance. As I spent time with Lichtenberg, I asked about one of the pressing fears with psychosis, eruptions of violence. What he recounted was akin to what I heard at Afaya, where I was told there was just one incident in 10 years when a staff member suffered two black eyes and was threatened with a pair of scissors. Lichtenberg said that chairs have been broken and plates smashed, but that threats against other residents, Melavim, or staff members are rare. With the exception of one broken nose, the situations have ended with hardly more than a scratch. Though one Malava was put in a headlock before being released without injury. If someone becomes intimidating, Lichtenberg said, I'll sometimes put my hands behind my back, look him in the eyes and tell him, if you want to attack me, it's going to be so easy for you. Occasionally, the Israeli soterias will insist on medication if a resident becomes too belligerent. But the drug is almost as often an anti-anxiety pill as an antipsychotic. And the dose may then be tapered down sometimes to nothing. The House refuses to take a small fraction of applicants because of a recent history of violence, but they also have knowingly accepted residents who a few months or only a few weeks before their arrival put a parent in the hospital, for example, or assaulted a government security officer. Avraham Friedlander, a former director of Lichtenberg's first house, told me about a resident who, on the man's first day, interrupted a group meeting in the living room. He splintered a darbuka, a Middle Eastern drum, and began to dance aggressively. In response, Friedlander joined him in the middle of the group, dancing wildly. Everybody made a drum beat with their feet, stomping, and we fought in a choreographed way, a dance fight. Friedlander said, he grabbed me, he put me on the floor, but I wasn't hurt, and later we talked. He was asking what was happening to his mind. He was crying. I slept near him that night, and when he woke with nightmares, I sang him songs, gave him tea. Soteria's methods may seem romantic and naive, but Lichtenberg has won the support of Israel's health ministry and two of Israel's four public insurance carriers, as well as the defense ministry's insurance system, will pay for a stay in Soteria as an alternative to hospitalization. Since Lichtenberg got started in 2016, 17 houses with practices similar to Soteria's have opened throughout Israel. This year, at the invitation of one of Jerusalem's major psychiatric institutions, Kfar Shaul Psychiatric Hospital, Lichtenberg has taken over its locked ward and begun to turn it into a Soteria facility. In the United States, the mainstream mental health establishment has been slower to embrace these alternative approaches, but that might be changing. I asked Ashwin Vasan, the new commissioner of New York City's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, whose most recent work has been in mental health, about how cities like New York and San Francisco should respond to a spike in violence and overall lawlessness attributed to the mentally ill and those who don't have housing. His email reply focused on preventing crises not only by adherence to medication, but also by breaking extreme isolation. As part of this effort, he added, we must also combat the notion that people with mental illness are to be feared. The data does much to support Vasan, suggesting that while those with hallucinations and delusions are probably disproportionately prone to violence. This pattern largely disappears when researchers control for factors like poverty, homelessness, and substance abuse. Those may be the more relevant drivers. Data also indicates that people diagnosed with psychosis are less likely to be perpetrators of violence than they are to be victims. Taku Mathai, whose Indian family immigrated to the United States when he was a child, works as a project director with a large New York State-funded program, OnTrack NY, which combines an emphasis on medication with the inclusion of client perspectives about their care. And he facilitates hearing voices groups. During one of our many conversations, Mathai told me a parable about a traveler in a foreign land coming across a bird he's never seen before, a peacock. Thinking that such a freakish creature will never survive, the traveler cuts off its feathers to correct nature's error. Mathai, who hears voices and has visions and was hospitalized after a suicide attempt as a teenager, is something like a peacock, except that he rejects medications that would shear away his difference. By immersing himself in yogic practices, he gives his mind a measure of rest. Still, voices stalk him, suspicious of people and full of foreboding. Sometimes, he told me, he thinks about whether, if the perfect antipsychotic existed, he would take it. "My experience is so rich," he said. "I wouldn't trade it for anything." He spoke of having a keen empathy for the singularity and solitude of others, a sensitivity that can bring a feeling of being universally joined. Beth, who asked that I use only her first name and who has led HVN groups in Western Massachusetts, pointed out that though the Hearing Voices movement wrestles against conventional psychiatry, it isn't anti-psychiatry. A former music teacher and cellist, Beth used to take medications that left her with terrible tremors and a torturous physical restlessness called akathisia, deepening the agony of a teaching career lost to her struggles. But after an odyssey of working with inflexible psychiatrists, she found one willing to chart a path of mutual understanding and compromise. She continues to have unsettling visions, but a religious practice, along with a calibrated mix of drugs, helps somewhat to make her life more manageable, while inflicting only mild tremors. And she's playing her cello for the first time in 20 years. It's like an ecosystem of dreams, Dmitry Gutkovich says, describing his voices to me over Zoom from Foster City, California. Some threaten his family, others speak philosophically on entropy. He takes an almost negligible dose of an antipsychotic, an amount bordering on a placebo. More relevant, he explained, is that HVN groups help him to realize that coexistence with voices is possible. It is, he said, about understanding them and their intentions so that we can live in harmony. It's about relationship management. A decade ago, in his early 20s, he was not in a period of perfect functioning, he says wryly. The professional assessment was doom and gloom. He's now married and a new father. On the screen, he smiles beatifically about this. He's a marketing director at a magazine and oversees an 8-person team. Sometimes, at the end of a conversation with Mazel Carlton, a mother will ask, "When can we talk again? When?" There is nothing like the panic of a parent whose son or daughter knows another reality. In her office late one afternoon in March, with the overhead light off and the light from the lone window getting dim, she counseled a mother for the second time by Zoom. The woman's grown son believed he was taking directions from God. In the recent past, he'd been hospitalized, suicidal, homeless. "He thinks he's kind of like a savior," she told Mazel Carlton. "His ever-changing plans terrified her. I need to know how to talk to him. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I'm just trying to be there, to be empathetic." She knew Mazel Carlton's lessons well, and quietly, Mazel Carlton echoed and encouraged her. but I don't know how to get him to understand that I'm on his side. He's very turned off to the mental health system. He told me I put him in the hospital. I said it wasn't true. It was the psychiatrist. I know he's going to do what he's going to do. I know I can't prevent it, but he says he was comfortable being homeless because no one could tell him anything. And now, what if he becomes homeless again? He could be killed, God forbid. I'm not putting this on you, Maslow Carlton said, but it sounds like he's had some institutional trauma. So what I might avoid is bringing things up from a mental health lens. I think about the M word, she said, talking about medication, but I don't say it. I think that's wise. I can't help it. I think it's good that you don't go there, Maslow Carlton said. Pharmaceuticals are easily accessible. He knows that. He knows he can make that choice anytime. When a mom brings up medication, it can sound like, I don't like the way you are. Like the way you are makes me uncomfortable. I'm freaking out. As adults, the moments when we feel that our parents trust us, that's the lottery-like feeling, Maslow Carlton said. To let him be who he is, the mother said, not to get in his face, I'm really working on it. I know you are. The author, Daniel Bergner, is a contributing writer for the magazine. This article is adapted from his book, The Mind and the Moon, My Brother's Story, The Science of Our Brains and the Search for Our Psyches, published this month by Echo. Dana Singer is a photographer based in Philadelphia, as well as a lecturer at Yale School of Art in Princeton. In 2020, she was named a Guggenheim Fellow. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. How I Learned to Live with Ghosts. The Korean tradition of Jesa, that's J-E-S-A, or memorializing ancestors, helped me understand that our loved ones continue to shape our lives long after they departed. It's a story by Joseph Han. According to my paternal grandmother, I've always been receptive to spirits. She likes to remind me how I would wake her up in the middle of the night, hyperventilating, as I tried to explain that my spirit had left my body and that I had found my nose pressed against the ceiling as I hovered over my bed. That I had lost my eyes and couldn't see. Back in my body, I rubbed my arms and wrapped them around my legs, not sure if they had actually returned. For many nights, I continued to jolt awake, crashing back into my body as if dropped from a great height. My life was haunted by what my family would not say, by the silence cloaking my life like a specter. My grandmother spoke, but mostly about the Bible. Later in her life, Christianity became a stronghold that she would turn to as a form of protection and that she passed on to me. It was also the way she avoided speaking about our family's history. But the more you try to dismiss ghosts, the more aggressively they will seek you out. In the case of my family and countless others, this unspeakable and forgotten past still haunts the present, bound in the brutal history of the Korean War, which is ongoing given the lack of a peace treaty. Koreans have maintained a long tradition of remembering the dead and acknowledging how they once ushered our lives forward, nurturing our bodies and spirits. Jesa, or ancestral rites, honoring loved ones who've passed. Though Jesa is performed as a ceremony on special occasions, it can be practiced as a daily mode of being. It's an accomplishment that we live with ghosts every day, and that a fulfilling life is one that honors our connection to them and thus to one another. Our health and peace depend on the feasts we can make of memory, the nourishment it provides both the living and the dead. If not, we run the risk of having starved lives in this one and the next. In the Jesa ceremony, we prepare a large table brimming with food, invite our ancestors to eat, and pour them a glass of matmekjioli, and alcoholic rice beverage. They partake in the feast. We commune with our dead, showing our respect by bowing to their portraits set before us. After we feed our dead, we too are invited to eat. First time I practiced Jessa was at my childhood best friend's home on the anniversary of her grandmother's death. My mother found it endearing that I participated. My grandmother was furious. She always taught me that our reunification with loved ones is deferred upon entry to the kingdom of heaven. Ancestor worship was a sin that jeopardized my access to that prize. My grandmother told me to never get involved again. After all, the worst thing that could happen would be missing this opportunity to reunite, knowing your family is out of reach if you are condemned to hell. Rather than reflect on my family's history, I was told to not look back, to pray and move on. But I imagined our family I would never know, hungry, restless, and lost. Who has not been accounted for? I imagined empty tables, uprooting walls of fence stretching for miles across the DMZ between North and South Korea, blooming to reach every corner of the Korean Peninsula. What would it take to keep our spirits fed? My grandmother never spoke to me about the war until 2018. Inspired by peace talks between the two Koreas, she recalled how the entire peninsula was devastated by war, a result of indiscriminate bombings by the United States, which dropped well over 500,000 tons of napalm and explosive ordnance combined, contributing to more than 4 million casualties, more than half of whom were civilians. My grandmother, who was 9 when the war started in 1950, grabbed her sisters and ran out of their home while bombs dropped on their village. She and her sisters avoided the fate of their cousin, who died when the force of a blast knocked over a ceramic medicine jar that crashed on her head. I don't know this cousin's name, for my grandmother will not say it. But I think about these family members I've never met, the parents of my grandparents, their parents, and beyond, and what they survived. Whether we believe in ghosts or not, they beckon us toward what cannot be forgotten. What they endured became the foundation and promise of our lives. I don't believe the dead are waiting for us to arrive. They are already with us, waiting to be seen. Understanding that this reality, that our loved ones' memories and histories suffuse our world and continue to shape our lives long after they have been departed, may help us begin to heal all they had suffered in this world. Through reading and writing, an experience not too different from the shock of leaving my body as a child, I've traced the contours of my family's ghosts. I pass through portals and find them waiting for an occasion for them to speak through me, though I must also let them go and eventually come back to myself. The practice of Jessa has taught me not to fear ghosts or death, if I can make a feast and an invitation of my life. Perhaps we all can, if we are alert enough, make room for their presence and find a way to relish this life for all of us, so that we may all keep living on. Joseph Hahn is the author of the forthcoming debut novel, Nuclear Family, published by Counterpoint Press, 2022. I'll read another Asian themed letter of recommendation. It's from China. Forget about perfection. Embrace Mamahuhu. That's spelled M-A-M-A-H-U-H-U. Mamahuhu. The Chinese expression became my family's motto for the haphazard nature of living on the margins. This is a story by Vanessa Hua. As a kid, I spoke English to my Chinese immigrant parents, who replied to me and my siblings mostly in kind. My grandmother, who lived with us, was different. She could communicate to us only in Mandarin. What we couldn't understand in words, we'd figure out through pantomime. A few phrases in Mandarin are particularly vivid to me, the ones my parents used when they grumbled about something: hulahutu, or muddle-headed, fa-fing, or to go crazy, and most striking of all, mamahu, which means so-so or mediocre, and also careless. In Mandarin, ma means horse and hu means tiger. The idiom mamahuhu literally translates then as horse, horse, tiger, tiger. In one of the fables that explains its origin, a slapdash artist paints a tiger's head, but changes his mind midway and completes the creature with a horse's body. Entomologically, it most likely began as a colloquialism borrowed from Manchu culture during the Qing dynasty. According to Chairman Mao's personal physician, 1956, the revered leader met an elderly woman living in a dilapidated shack on an island in the Jiang River. When he asked about her quality of life, instead of proclaiming that the revolution had liberated her, she defiantly muttered, "Mamahuhu." She hadn't experienced the prosperity that Mao had promised. Mamahuhu became a family in-joke for me and my siblings. At first, we found the concept funny, and the sound of it, too. Sometimes my brother and I chanted the string of vowels, hooting the hoo like owls, bewildering our parents, before dissolving into laughter. But as we grew older, we realized Mamahuhu also described our family. My parents and my grandmother could be precise when it mattered, say when my father, structural engineer, conducted a total stress test analysis of the Sears Tower, as it was known then. But they handled much else inexactly, with varying degrees of success. My grandmother could pleat pork dumplings with grace and speed, but when she packed my lunchbox, she stacked an inch of processed meat between white bread with no condiments, in imitation of the American sandwiches she rarely ate. My mother is a retired plant physiologist whose research led to multiple patents related to improving plant growth and food safety. But when she helped me on an elementary school project, she scooped out steamed rice to use as an adhesive instead of buying a glue stick. My tinfoil crown fell apart in class. Neither my grandmother nor my mother had been schooled in American norms. They had to fake it to make it. When I was a child, the mamahuhu attitude sometimes embarrassed me, but it also taught me not to get hung up on mainstream ideas of perfection and to embrace originality instead. That old woman who told the truth to Mao didn't seek his approval by telling him what everyone else did, and among her neighbors, only she remained sharp in the memories of his physician. My elders, too, forged their own path in a country that could be hostile to or dismissive of Asian immigrants. Out of a sense of pride, my siblings and I transformed Mamahu from an adjective into an ethos. It's the name we gave my mother's car, and it's the philosophy behind my brother's repairs around the house or on vehicles. So-so, good enough, he told me, because a lot of the time, that's all that's needed. Growing up, I talked about Mamahuhu only at home, but lately, as elements of Chinese culture have spread throughout the world, I realized my family isn't alone in our affection for the term. A Michelin-starred chef playfully borrowed the expression for his restaurant in San Francisco, as did sketch comedians in Shanghai who specialized in viral videos. With their own line of Mamahuhu logoed apparel, throw pillows, and face masks. A Paris restaurant group chose the name to break free from the conventional codes of Asian food and embrace their quirky side. Various accounts on TikTok, Twitter, and Instagram use the word in their names. It's also an entry in the Urban Dictionary. My sons who are of Chinese, Serbian, and Northern European descent, don't speak Mandarin, but they find the Mamahuhu fable darkly hilarious. That's probably how I would have drawn the picture too, one said. It's our family practice to make do, and as the pandemic set in, no in-person school, no travel possible, the philosophy helped us survive. I hiked with my twins in the hills, doling out starbursts or Skittles every half mile, history, science, and recess all in one. At times inspired, at times Mama Hoo with its power, possibility, and irreverence. With this clear-eyed worldview, my 10-year-olds don't rely on tradition or precedence as their only guide. They understand that best laid plans are no guarantee of safety or happiness. It's a lesson, one of Mama Hoo-Hoo's many, that I want to impress upon them most of all. Last summer, our family considered visiting Hawaii, and again for spring break earlier this year, but we've repeatedly postponed the vacation because of the pandemic. In the end, we settled for a road trip to Southern California to see their grandparents and baby cousin. As the blankness of the interstate scrolled by, I asked the boys if they were excited. "This trip is Mama Hoo-Hoo," one joked. Everyone laughed. A manifesto for the next generation, too. Now I'll read a featured story from the Times. Why is Bob's Burgers such a freakishly lovable? Why is Bob's Burgers so freakishly lovable? This guy. Lauren Bouchard's accidental career as a comedy mogul has now brought his TV family to the big screen. There's a drawing of, to the right of that title. Guy smiling. He's got a beard and black hair receding almost halfway down to the top of his head. It shows some of the other characters from Bob Burgers floating around. This is a story by Karina Chocana. Chocano. Sometimes Lauren Bouchard thinks about how close he came to having a totally different life from the one he has now, one that would not exist if he hadn't bumped into his elementary school science teacher in Harvard Square one day in 1993. He was 23 at the time, high school dropout, who had spent the previous 5 years working odd jobs, museum guard, bouncer, bartender. At one point, he created a cartoon about a bartending dog and submitted it to a novelty book publisher who rejected it. Then one day, as he was leaving an art supply store, he ran into Tom Snyder, his former teacher and an ex-colleague of his father's. Snyder ran a company that made educational software for classrooms and now was expanding into animation. He asked Bouchard if he still liked to draw. Bouchard did. And so Snyder hired him to work on a project that would eventually become the animated cable TV comedy Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist. Bouchard told me this story on a sunny afternoon at the dining table of his beautiful house on the hills of Los Angeles. Without that chance encounter in Cambridge, he told me, as his wife Holly made us popcorn and one of his two sons did homework nearby, he might never have found his way here to any of this, never gotten into animation, met his collaborators, met his wife, won 2 Emmys, made a movie, or taken up growing walnuts or fostering baby goats on his farm in Ojai, California. "I know it's a cliche," he says, "of the transformative effects that one coincidence had on his life, but it's like stunning sometimes, the magnitude of the difference." Bouchard is now one of the most influential figures in adult animation, best known as the creator of the Fox hit Bob's Burgers. The show is currently in its 12th season, putting it among the longest-running animated comedies, with a feature film, the Bob's Burgers movie, arriving in theaters now. Bouchard also has a newer show, Central Park, an animated musical series he created with Josh Gad and Nora Smith for Apple TV+. He's also an executive producer on The Great North, created by two former Bob's writers, Wendy Molyneux and Lizzie Molyneux Longlin, along with Minty Lewis. Bob's is about a lower middle class family and the restaurant they run together, making it at once a family comedy and a workplace comedy. It centers on Bob Belcher, the anxious and pessimistic owner of a struggling burger joint that, despite his talent, never seems to catch on, and his wildly optimistic wife, Linda, plus their three weird kids, Tina, boy-crazed, butt-fixated, Gene, flamboyant, obsessed with food, music, and fart jokes, and Louise, adorable, scheming, borderline sociopathic. An atmospheric grossness clings to the Belchers like burger grease, and yet despite Bob's hairy arms, Tina's excruciating adolescence, and Gene's booger play, the show never treats the Belchers as objects of contempt. In fact, it runs on the deep affection and respect it has for them and they have for one another. They seem, of all things, oddly dignified. When a mean girl steals Tina's mortifying journal of erotic friend fiction and threatens to read it to everyone at school, the whole family rallies to recover it. But not before Tina, inspired by her mother's pep talk encouraging her to be herself, preemptively reads one of her sagas to the student body as her siblings look on, cringingly protective. Adult animation has often been a space for cynicism and snark, but Bouchard has long gone against that grain. H. John Benjamin, who plays Bob, recalls a moment in the mid-90s when he and Bouchard were taking Dr. Katz to Comedy Central. They were shown an early presentation for South Park, which was soon to begin its quarter-century run on the same channel, and saw doom. "It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen animated," Benjamin says, "and we were doing this very low-energy thing, a show full of shambling, introspective conversations that Bouchard described as secretly a love story between a father and a son." With Bob's, Bouchard wanted to create something equally rooted in kindness, rejecting the classic sitcom convention of the family as a conflict machine. He recalls one executive saying the family members love each other a little too much, warning him that even a family that loves each other fights. The show premiered in 2011 as a mid-season replacement and began to gain momentum around its third or fourth season. But it really took off when it became available on streaming services, letting viewers spend longer, more intimate hours with the Belchers. Marcy Proietto, the head of the Disney unit that produces the show, told me that people sometimes tell her, "We fall asleep to Bob's." And I'm always like, "Oh, that's a weird thing to say to me." But they mean it in a really loving way. They mean it like, "That's my comfort food." From the start, Bouchard and the writers knew they wanted the Belchers to live persistently on the edge of failure, always feeling the pressure when you love your kids but you know that every moment you're not working could be the nail in your coffin. The other thing they knew was that they were telling the story of an artist. Every day, Bob offers a fanciful but impractical new burger special. The Eggers can't be cheesers with fried egg and cheese. The cauliflower's coming from inside the house. The let's give 'em something shiitake bout to an indifferent world. Occasionally someone verges on recognizing Bob's genius. The family landlord gives them a break after tasting one of Bob's creations and declaring him a true beef artist or beef artist. A now wealthy friend from college invests in the business, but his corny marketing ploys alienate Bob, who cannot compromise his vision. Driven by his creative urges, Bob communes with food. He actually talks to it, tenderly, and then does voices to pretend it can talk back to him. We knew that he was going to be compelled to make these burgers that were not practical, Bouchard says, and that there was going to be a restaurant across the street that was ridiculously bad and yet successful because it was practical. What the writers didn't know, because there was no way to tell what 12 seasons worth of stories would build, was that this premise would yield a remarkable study in optimism and grit. The constant question, as Bouchard puts it, of what happens when you're faced with your failure. The new film stares even further into that abyss. It begins with a literal collapse. A water main breaks, causing a sinkhole to open in front of the restaurant just before one of the year's busiest weekends. Naturally, the rent is due, as is a loan payment. Just as it seems things couldn't get worse, a grisly discovery threatens to sink the restaurant for good. Bob despairs. He sees the end, Bashar says. At one point, things get so bleak that the Belchers, that even Linda loses heart. It's impossible to watch Bob's over a long period of time and not understand that the world is chaotic, cruel, and profoundly unfair. That terrible things happen to good people, while bad people get away with murder. Bob's seems to understand that we never really know what circumstance will yield. In one episode, Bob lucks into a profile in an influential magazine, an opportunity that could change everything, only to have his kids' pranks accidentally leave him glued to a toilet seat on the day of the interview. Yet, beautiful things can be forged from tragedy, too, and that is consoling. When Bouchard was in ninth grade, his mother was diagnosed with cancer and died within a year. Till then, his childhood had felt charmed. He was born in New York City, where his father, a painter, worked as a building superintendent. But the family had soon moved away, first to a defunct dairy farm in Massachusetts, full of dogs and roosters and trees to climb. Bouchard remembers his parents having little money, but not letting that interfere with their creative pursuits or their children's good time. His mother, a writer with degrees from Brandeis and Harvard, struggled with the isolation. She got a doctorate, and eventually the family moved to Medford, where she taught English at Tufts. Bouchard's father got a job teaching art at the Shady Hill School in Cambridge. Tom Snyder, who taught science there, recalls going to dinner at the Bouchard house, where the garage studio was filled with acres of canvas. Bouchard drew all the time, too. Recently, while cleaning out their father's house, his younger sister, Erica, found a business card Lauren made in fifth grade reading, "Lauren Bouchard, cartoonist." "Obviously, I have to frame our whole childhood around our mother's death," Erica told me. "There is sort of the before and the after, a house full of love and laughter, and then a death that left the family rudderless for a long time. One thing they did after was talk about family businesses they could start. People sometimes ask me, 'Do you see your family in Lauren's show or in the characters?' she said. And the thing that resonates with me is that they genuinely like each other and they like spending time with each other. I mean, we pulled together after Mom died. It was like, well, who else would we want to work with if not each other?" Bouchard got through 10th grade before, he says, the wheels started to come off. The following year, he found himself unable to do homework. By senior year, he wasn't going to any classes besides studio art. In April, the headmaster called him in and said, "I think you want me to kick you out, so I'm not going to. You have to make this decision." Bouchard left that day. "He was right," said of the headmaster's move. "I was like, yeah, of course. That's what I'm waiting for." 5 years later, on the day of that chance meeting in Cambridge, Snyder had just returned from a trip to Los Angeles, where he was asked to produce interstitial animations for HBO. His company was focused on educational software. He was also a fan of improv comedy, and he realized that a cheap new form of animation he invented might pair well with digital audio, which made it easier to wrestle improvisational dialogue into a streamlined edit. A producer friend introduced him to the Boston comedian Jonathan Katz, and the idea for Dr. Katz, professional therapist, started to take shape. Katz would play a psychologist, leading different stand-ups through their talk therapy sessions. Bouchard had no particular background in comedy and no formal training in animation, editing, audio engineering, writing for television, or production of any kind. Snyder hired him as a jack of all trades, but he would end up pitching in almost every aspect of the show. The comedians, H. John Benjamin and Laura Silverman, who were dating at the time, went in to audition for parts. The setup surprised them. Bouchard, Benjamin says, had converted Tom's pantry into a recording booth. He hung a mic and secured it. He put a chair in and was sitting with a bunch of cans of vegetables. I sort of thought it might have been a prank show or something. Benjamin was cast as Dr. Katz's layabout son, and Silverman as his receptionist. We would go in and record an hour of random conversation, Benjamin says, and Lord would take that and edit it down to a 3-minute scene. Most primetime animated shows start with scripts that are handed off to storyboard artists. The voices are then recorded one at a time, after which a rough animatic and later the finished animation are created. With Dr. Katz, however, Snyder's interest in digital editing and improvisation converged. The cast recorded together, capturing their rapport and preserving their interaction. Dialogue was then edited down into a kind of radio play, which was sent to an illustrator to create images. Snyder's visual innovation, squiggle vision, used very little animated movement, just drawings whose wobbling lines gave them a sense of motion. I boiled the lines down, he says now. Snyder called his audio-first process retro-scripting, and it took weeks. Bouchard would put the audio on cassette tapes and listen in his car. He would play them for his father and sister. The pleasure I took in it was so high, he says. I loved hearing their voices. I loved trying to find the right pieces to make it all work. Snyder, Katz, and the comedian Bill Broaddus wrote outlines and then scripts. But the finished product was always built from both the script run-throughs and hours of improvisation, which Bouchard would painstakingly piece together into something magical. Dr. Katz premiered in 1995 and ran for 6 seasons, prompting a creative chain reaction. Snyder was approached about doing new shows for DreamWorks, FX, and UPN, and created Science Court, on which Bouchard worked as a producer. A year later, he suggested that Bouchard create something of his own, centered on a local comedian he liked, just as they had done with Jonathan Katz. Bouchard frequented a comedy club on the 3rd floor of a Chinese restaurant in Cambridge, where 2 roommates, Brendan Small and Eugene Merman, used to perform. Bouchard and Small created Home Movies, about a weird, film-obsessed kid who worked through his problems by making movies on his camcorder for UPN, where it lasted only 5 episodes. But one of the people who watched it was the TV executive, Khaki Jones, who picked it up for a four-season run on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. By this time, Bouchard had followed his girlfriend, Holly Kretschmar, whom he met while working on Dr. Katz, to a job in New York, and then another in San Francisco. When Home Movies was canceled, he had an idea to do a version of The Omen with Damien as an angsty teenager, but he couldn't get the rights. Instead, he came up with Lucy, the Daughter of the Devil, which would run on Adult Swim. Once again, Bouchard built a little studio, this one in the Mission. He met Nora Smith, whose father worked for Adult Swim, and eventually hired her, impressed both with her skill with editing and her sense of humor. Since working with H. John Benjamin on Dr. Katz, his first voice acting role, Bouchard has cast him in every show he's made. On this one, he would play Lucy's dad, Satan. Holly Schlesinger, whom Bouchard first hired as an intern on Dr. Katz, came on board. Now she's a writer and executive producer on Bob's Burgers. Many people have followed Bouchard from show to show, some bouncing between voices and production work. Eugene Merman, Laura Silverman, and her sister Sarah, Melissa Barden-Galski, Ron Lynch, Damon Wong, Andy Kindler, Sam Setter, John Glasser. That garage band quality, the homegrown quality, did work for us, Bouchard said of his early years in Boston, and the unique way he was able to develop his way toward the mainstream. I think of Bob's as a cable show that snuck onto a broadcast. I totally get anybody who wants to move here to Los Angeles and work their way from the bottom up. But I also occasionally find myself wanting to say, like, no, stay. Stay where you are and do it over there. And then you can really write your own ticket. One day, Susanna Mackles, then the vice president for comedy development at Fox, saw an animation reel with 30 seconds of Lucy on it. I'll never forget the scene, she told me. Lucy asks her father, the devil, to buy her a dress. And he's like, sure, what size are you? And she's like, I'm a 4. And he's like, are you really a 4? I don't want to have to return it. It was so pitch perfect, so like a terrible dad. Mackles called Bouchard and asked him to pitch something to Fox. When he did, Mackles felt an immediate connection, one of just a handful of times in her career, and she told me when she has sat with someone and known. Bouchard told her he always loved the idea of a family that ran a restaurant. He was thinking of a couple of pizza places he knew, but figured burgers were more iconic. Then he got nervous that this wasn't enough of a concept, so he pitched the Belchers as a family of cannibals. Mackles wasn't sold on the idea of 100 episodes of cannibal jokes, but she loved the rest. I've never really talked about this, she told me, but my parents had a little diner that went bankrupt when I was a kid. They had red stools, the whole thing. The Belchers, she said, felt real. They can't pay the rent, and they have a crazy landlord. Or they want to send Tina to horse camp, but they can't afford it. Just their reality. It's not depressing, but we're not shying away from the truth of that. Before Bouchard developed the characters of the show, he already knew who would play them. H. John Benjamin would play Bob, of course. Linda would be played by John Roberts, whose YouTube videos of himself playing a character like his mother caught Bouchard's attention. The comics Kristen Schaal and Eugene Merman, he thought, were natural voices for kids. They felt like siblings to me already. Then one day, Benjamin called him up and said, you really have to hear this guy's voice. He was talking about a writer and stand-up he worked with on Important Things with Dimitri Martin, Dan Mintz. People laughed at everything he said, and it was partly because of his voice, flat, dry, and weirdly somnolent. Bouchard decided to cast Mintz as Daniel, the elder brother of the family. Except Kevin Reilly, then head of Fox, didn't like Daniel. He felt he'd seen that character a million times. Louise and Jean were fresh. Daniel was not. Bouchard took this note, came up with the idea of making Daniel a girl named Tina, frozen in puberty, forever obsessed with boys and horses. Mackles loved the idea. He was never resistant, reluctant, or mad, she says. He just did it. And then he said, but we're still going to have Dan voice her. Bouchard approaches casting as though he's composing music. He told me he chooses actors largely for the quality of their voices and for how those voices might sound together. You start picturing this family, and it makes some kind of musical sense to you, he said, just like bass and drums and piano and guitar. It's a sharp ear that can listen to the voices of Mintz and Benjamin and not only hear that it will work to have one play the other's awkward teenage daughter, but build a show in which that daughter actually becomes the breakout character. Mintz had been using his deadpan monotone to deliver surreal one-liners. Benjamin is known in part for playing cocky blowhards like the lead character on Archer. A repeat note he has received from Bouchard says is, don't be so mean. But on Bob's, playing an anxious teenager and a dad patiently supporting her, they have a real and unexpected tenderness in their interactions. Just as on Dr. Katz, everything is built on the unique interplay of these voices and sensibilities. Watching a Zoom meeting of Bob's writers, I was struck not by the ease and lack of hierarchy, like a family writing about a family, but by the way that as adjustments were made to a script, the better joke didn't always win. Pacing, tone, and trueness to character were more essential. The show's humor, Bouchard would tell me later, is so character-driven as to be almost fragile. Each line needs to be delivered with just so, or it risks throwing off the entire scene. It's not this bulletproof joke that can work with any delivery. At one point, in Bouchard's small home studio filled with books and instruments and recording equipment, I saw him attend to a last-minute query. Louise was delivering a rousing speech in her usual sarcastic way, and the words were underscored with some rousing music. But was it too rousing? It seemed funny to me, but Bouchard's ear decided against it. If people took it seriously, it might come across as manipulative, insincere. A couple of weeks after meeting at his house, I caught up with Bouchard again via Zoom, and he'd been thinking about animation and how it works. I understand how it's done, he told me, but I don't understand how it works. You know what I mean? It was mysterious to him that our minds could be tricked into accepting these drawings as real people. He wondered if something about the form entered the brain differently than live action. I wondered aloud if this might be related to the fact that in animation, time doesn't pass. Characters don't grow or age or even change clothes. They remain stuck in an eternal present, expressing the same essential characteristics over and over until something clicks. Many of the show's fans turn to it in part because it can be soothing. Lately, I've found myself watching it for the same reason. Bad, unfair things happen all the time. A bad, unfair thing happened to me while writing this, and it can be consoling to see others struggle together without losing hope. The Belchers, decidedly non-aspirational, exist in an unjust, disappointing, fart-choked world. But they have built something comforting within it. They create meaning by focusing on the next burger, on the next musical showstopper, on the next erotic friend fiction story, or power-hungry scheme, and of course, more than anything, and always, on one another. Karina Chocano is the author of the essay collection, You Play the Girl, and a contributing writer for the magazine. She frequently writes for the magazine's Screenland column. I'll end with a poem about grief, and it's titled Poem, One Afternoon You Fixed Me, and it's by Mark Bibbins. One afternoon, you fixed me lunch in your tiny apartment, cream of mushroom soup from a can and English muffins. As you set our bowls on a blanket on the floor because you didn't own a table, you put on a bad British accent and said, "We're having crumpets." It was raining, but there was an abundance of light coming somehow from a source outside we couldn't see. From here, that light feels like what music sounds like just before the record skips. I'll read it again. One Afternoon You Fixed Me by Mark Bibbins. One afternoon you fixed me. Lunch in your tiny apartment, cream of mushroom soup from a can and English muffins. As you set our bowls on a blanket on the floor because you didn't own a table, you put on a bad British accent and said, "We're having crumpets." It was raining, but there was an abundance of light coming somehow from a source outside we couldn't see. From here, that light feels like what music sounds like just before the record skips. Mark Bibbins is an American poet whose latest collection is 13th Balloon, Copper Canyon Press 2020, from which this poem is taken. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.